Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Good morning. The Scriptures speak very profoundly and powerfully regarding children. God has honored human beings by allowing them to cooperate with Him in the creating and in the training of children. The inspired psalmist puts all of this in the right perspective. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of thy youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. Psalm 127, 3 through 5. Tragically and inexplicably, our culture has become anti-child. I have a question I need to ask you. Who owns our children? Their parents or the state? The question may seem totally irrelevant and even insulting, but I assure you it is not. Actually, neither parents nor the state actually own children. They are owned, just as the rest of us are, by God Almighty. But parents, not the state, are placed in charge of children, unless children's lives are in danger. And then the state has an obligation to protect children, just as it protects the rest of us. Scholars from many disciplines and just ordinary people are deeply disturbed at the government's intrusion into American families. Let me give you some very troubling examples. Brenda Scott's new book, Out of Control, Who's Watching Our Child Protection Agencies, gives numerous examples of the states illegally and immorally interfering with our families. The following story is one of the most gruesome I have ever read anywhere, and is just one evidence that the child abuse industry is out of control. 8-year-old Alicia was sleeping on the ground floor of Naval housing where her parents lived. A rapist slipped through the window of Alicia's room, took her outside the home, raped and sodomized the child. Her parents noticed she was having some physical problems. They took her to a doctor. The physician reported that the child had been sexually assaulted. The father admitted that something serious was wrong and asked that the incident be reported to the authorities. The child told the doctor that a stranger had entered her room through a window and had assaulted her. After the doctor's examination, social workers entered the picture, and that is where the nightmare began. The Department of Social Services filed charges against the parent. The very next day, social workers kidnapped Alicia and placed her in a foster home. A San Diego grand jury found that social workers had lied, falsified evidence, and disobeyed court orders, and such actions were typical. Page 13. A family counselor accused the parents of abusing their child. She began a brutal brainwashing campaign, paid for by federal tax dollars. The counselor required the mother to treat the father as if he were dead when Alicia was present. She accused the mother in front of her son of participating in the rape of the child. Jim Wade, Alicia's father, was arrested and charged with raping and sodomizing his little girl. Page 15. Here is one of the most troubling aspects of the case. The police investigators, the social worker, and the therapist were all aware of the probable identity of Alicia's assailant within days of the attack. Page 15. The Department of Social Services worker and the counselor discussed ways of twisting the detective's statements so that they could keep Alicia away from her parents. One of the prosecutors from the district attorney's office perjured herself about the facts in this case. DNA tests proved conclusively that the father could not have raped his daughter. What was the tragic end of this unbelievable story? this innocent family was financially ruined by costs exceeding $260,000 prior to being billed for the foster care of the child. Pages 17 and 18. Are you aware that a child can be removed from its home because of inadequate housing, messy housekeeping, or have become homeless? Losing a job can be a double whammy. It can cost you your children. The following conversation took place between Susan Gabriel, whose husband had been accused of child abuse, and a social worker. The caseworker: "We know your husband is guilty. You've got to force him into admitting it." Susan: "How do you know he is guilty?" Caseworker: "We know he is guilty because he says he is innocent. Guilty people always say they are innocent." Susan: "What do innocent people say?" The caseworker: "We're not in the business of guilt or innocence. We're in the business of putting families back together." Susan: "So why do not do that to us?" The caseworker: "Because Clark will not admit that he is guilty." Brenda Scott's book, Out of Control, Who's Watching Our Child Protection Agencies, is just one of a number of excellent books which outline the tragedy of child protection agencies in the United States. I recommend that all Americans read Brenda Scott's book, and I also recommend that you read Mary Pride's book, The Child Abuse Industry. Both books point out the grave dangers inherent in our departments of social services. Now, dear friends, here comes the shocker. The federal government is working feverishly to enforce what they call children's rights. I'm basing the remainder of our discussion today on an article by John Rosemond. Dr. Rosemond is a family psychologist in private practice in North Carolina. His article, "Are Children's Rights an Outrage?" appeared in the Huntsville Times on Sunday, May the 14th, 1995. Please listen carefully to Dr. Rosemond's opening paragraph. The major news media gave but passing mention of the fact that on February the 23rd, 1995, President Clinton signed the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children. This grave act deserved front page headlines, for it represents the most blatant move yet toward big government's meddling in family relationships. Page 84. There are some very important questions which need to be asked and answered on this excerpt from John Rosemond's opening paragraph. If the story is of such great significance, and I agree with Rosemond that it is, why did not the major news media give some attention to such a radical arrangement? Were the news media leaders afraid of the reaction of the American people to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children? If the news media had not agreed with President Clinton's action, do you think they would have remained quiet? They never have been quiet about any other proposal with which they disagreed. Since when does the United Nations have the right to decide what is best for the children of the world? Many of the most influential leaders in the United Nations come from countries which have done an even poorer job of rearing their children than have the people of this nation. Would the United States lose its sovereignty in dealing with the children of this nation? Would we not be obligated to abide by the rules and regulations of the nations which comprise the United Nations? Does that thought scare you? Dr. Rosemond says that the treaty requires that each signatory nation create and enforce laws pertaining to a long list of obligations relating to children's rights. Here is just a sampling of those requirements. Article 2 says it is primarily the responsibility of government to take whatever steps are necessary to provide for the well-being of children. Not the responsibility of parents, mind you, but the state. My friends, the state, as ordained by God, has certain obligations For example, governors and other political leaders are sent by God for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. 1 Peter 2:14. Do you notice one word in that reading or elsewhere in the Scriptures where the government has the right, perhaps even the obligation, to provide for the well-being of children? Obviously, if parents burn or stab or mistreat their children in other ways, the state has an obligation to protect those children. Incidentally, the state, in most cases, has failed miserably in providing for the protection of our children. In fact, it is a national disgrace the way children are removed from their homes and placed in foster homes, where there is far more abuse than in their natural homes. When will the government ever learn that it is not all-powerful or all-wise? Our governmental leaders have a moral obligation to focus on what they are supposed to be doing, and do that well, rather than getting involved in areas where they do not belong. Virtually every kind of work can be done better by the private sector than by government. Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and almost all other programs under government sponsorship are in shambles. Our financial situation in this nation will destroy our economy unless drastic steps are taken to avoid disaster. Why are governments of the world so blind to these facts? They cannot take care of children. They're not taking care of what they're supposed to be doing. Article 12 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children gives children the right to express views freely in all matters. Dr. Roseman comments, "One can envision a law which prevents parents from restricting their children from getting tattooed, wearing provocative clothing, or saying what they please to authority figures. If you were an uneducated pagan and wanted to propose the most ridiculous arrangement for children, how could you top this proposal? My sons have grown up to be respectable and respectful men. But when they were at home, they had to live by their parents' rules and regulations. They were not permitted to dress shabbily or provocatively. They were not allowed to speak disrespectfully of their parents, of their neighbors, or of their school teachers and administrators. If they failed to observe their parents' guidance, they were punished for it. Yes, they were spanked for disobedience and rebellion. Tragically, there are psychologists, psychiatrists, and others in places of responsibility with our children who hold the views being promoted by the United Nations. Could that explain why millions of America's young people take drugs, commit acts of violence, and in general have so little respect for our nation, for the schools, for the church, and for the family? Are our leaders so foolish that they think boys and girls will grow into manhood and womanhood with no discipline? Even cats and dogs have more judgment than some so-called child experts. Article 15 guarantees freedom of association. This implies, Dr. Roseman says, that parents would not be allowed to restrict a child's choice of friends. If your 14-year-old daughter wants to date an 18-year-old dropout with a police record, who are you to say she cannot? Is there anyone in my audience today who does not know the importance of our association? The inspired Apostle Paul wrote these words, "Be not deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits." 1 Corinthians 15:33. Other versions render that expression, "Evil companionships corrupt good morals." Children and adults tend to become like the people with whom they associate. If a child runs with the drug crowd or the sexually promiscuous group, you should expect him or her to be a drug addict or a fornicator or an adulterer or a homosexual. one of the greatest services parents can perform for their children is to teach them about their companion and to prevent their associating with the wrong crowd. Obviously, when young people reach the age of maturity, the parents may not have the same influence in their lives that they had when the children were small. But parents should never reach the point where they are not interested in their children's companion. Besides, many of those who claim to be child-rearing experts, such as psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and marriage and family counselors, have not done very well with their own children. There is some evidence they have actually done worse. Why are many Americans, especially governmental leaders, willing and even eager to listen to people who ignore the advice which God has given to parents and who themselves have done so poorly with their own families? I'm not saying that all psychiatrists and psychologists have failed in the rearing of their children, but their track record is not very impressive. God's instructions for parents are simple, powerful, and time-tested. These words I command you this day shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. Deuteronomy 6:6-8. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6:4. The word nurture in this verse would be better translated in modern times by the word discipline. God expects, in fact God demands, that parents discipline their children. Failure to discipline one's child is an affront to God Almighty, an abuse of the child, and an attack against society. Parents who fail to discipline are making a fatal mistake. Failure to discipline a child is as cruel as not feeding or properly clothing the child. In the long run, it might even be more cruel. Article 16 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children gives children the right to privacy, which might well be used to nullify state laws which require parental notification before minors can be given an abortion. Perhaps this also means that a teen has a right to lock his parents out of his room. What if a child brings drugs into his room? What if he is engaging in heterosexual or homosexual activity? Will parents under this treaty be forbidden to search the child's room and remove objectionable materials or persons? If any governmental leader or child expert thinks such an arrangement makes sense, he needs to be removed from having any influence, either in public office or in the private sector. Article 19 states that government shall take all appropriate legislative, administrative, social, and educational measures to protect the child from all forms of physical or mental violence, injury or abuse, neglect or negligent treatment, maltreatment or exploitation. Given what many helping professionals consider inappropriate discipline, this might include spanking, confining a child to his room, and putting a child to bed early. But maybe, just maybe, Dr. Rosemond is overreacting to this infamous proposal by the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children. Surely there are no reputable scholars who think of spanking as child abuse, are there? They all have more sense than that, do they not? No, my friends, they do not. One example will have to suffice, although it would not be difficult to give many more. Richard Gels, Murray Strauss, and Susan Steinmetz wrote a book in 1980 which they called Behind Closed Doors. These three scholars are well known in the field of child abuse. They define normal violence as any act carried out with the intention or perceived intention of causing physical pain. It can range from slight pain, as in a slap, to murder. Page 20. These eminent authors define family violence in such a way as to include the spanking of a child. For centuries, they write, our society has provided parents with the right and even the mandate to use hitting, slapping, spanking, and other physical force against children. Page 51. How many people intervene, they ask, when an adult spanks or slaps a child in a supermarket? Given that spankings and slaps are taken for granted, are they violent acts? Our answer is yes. Our view is that slaps and spankings are simply one end of a continuum of violent acts. Page 53. When one reads the writings of scholars like Gels, Strauss, and Steinmetz, he can understand why we should be upset over the crazy suggestions by the United Nations. If the agreement were ratified, your rights to rear your children as you believe God demands would be seriously curtailed. You might even end up in jail for spanking your child, or for restricting his rights, or even worse, you might have your child taken from you and given to people who have absolutely no sense about the rearing of children. I am not attempting to alarm you unnecessarily, but that is a distinct possibility in our culture. With God's help, and with the encouragement of family and friends, you can do better by your children than any governmental agency in the world. Since when does a 25-year-old social worker have the knowledge, the skill, and the compassion to be a parent or to know what good parenting is? I know there are good social work personnel. Some of them are my former students. But as a rule, they do not know what they are doing and would be forbidden by their supervisors to do right if they knew what right was and had the presence of mind to do it. I'm not making these charges lightly. I can document them if anyone wishes to challenge them. Article 27 recognizes the right of every child to a standard of living adequate for the child's physical, mental, spiritual, moral, and social development, and directs signatory nations to take steps to guarantee such a standard for every child. This sounds suspiciously like a mandate for more taxpayer-supported entitlement. Now a question. If both the United States and India signed the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children, will the same standards be applied in both countries? India is one of the poorest countries on earth, primarily because their religious and political philosophies have kept the people in bondage. The United States is one of the richest nations in the world. Will a poor person in India be treated the same as a poor person in the United States? Besides, the leaders, as a rule, in the United Nations have no basis for judging the physical, mental, spiritual, moral, and social development of children. To suggest otherwise is to exhibit great ignorance of our world. Article 43 sets up an international body of 10 child and family experts to make recommendations to signatory nations regarding compliance. In January, this committee admonished the United Kingdom for insufficient welfare spending, allowing spanking by parents, and for plans to incarcerate hardcore juvenile criminals. In short, the United Kingdom is being told to raise taxes to support more socialism and to coddle kids. The worse the kid, the more the coddling. Who are the experts who would advise the rest of the world on how to rear their children? Could they be people like Gell, Strauss, and Steinmetz? Or even worse, Could they be people like the radical pediatrician, Dr. Benjamin Spock? This same committee, Dr. Roseman says, has recommended that schools develop programs to educate children concerning their rights under the convention. In other words, parents would pay taxes to support schools which would teach their children when and how to challenge their parents' rules. My friends, there are many judges such as Patricia Wald, legislators such as Pat Schroeder, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and others who are pushing hard to take over the teaching and the rearing of your children. Incidentally, it almost happened when Richard Nixon was president. But there is one close to the White House who has lobbied for this radical agenda for years. I speak of none other than Hillary Rodham Clinton. This treaty has been a pet project of the Children's Defense Fund for several years. Hillary Clinton was the chairperson of that fund from 1986 to 1991. She does not want you to have control of your children. She wants the government to have it. Fortunately, Jesse Helms is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Helms will not allow the treaty to come before the Senate for confirmation. Dr. Roseman says concerning Senator Helms, he has pronounced disaffection for such things as UN committees that presume to know what's best for American families. My friends, please write or call and let Washington know your views on such matters. Our lesson next week will be, what rights do children actually have? Thank you for listening, and may God bless you.